Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. With me today is licensed clinical social worker and co-host of Line 1, Prentice Pemberton. Today, the two of us, are here to kind of address your questions about health, health care, mental and behavioral health. So if you have a concern that's keeping you up at night or otherwise preoccupying your mind, which might be about yourself, a close family member, or just someone you know, then this is an opportunity to give us a call, and we'll do our best to see if we can't do something to help. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. To get things started, the two of us are going to talk about anxiety. Prentice will talk about the psychosocial, mental, behavioral health aspects, and it'll give me a chance to maybe bring in how that interacts with the healthcare system, the traditional healthcare system, and medical problems. Then if we have time, we're also going to talk about what are called psychophysiologic disorders, problems that cause us to experience pain or discomfort that really have no clear, easily to understand organic origin and how stress or anxiety may contribute to that. But also, before we do that, let me give you a couple of other ideas of things you may have questions about. There's been a new recommendation to introduce peanuts as early as 4 months to infants to help prevent allergy to peanuts. What's that all about? What's the evidence? Is that a good thing to do? How do you do it? What's the risk? That's a question somebody may want to ask. And then I've always liked to hear what listeners out there think about our healthcare system. Should we have healthcare as a right? If so, what should be included? How good is our healthcare system? What do we do well? What do we do poorly? Do we spend too much for healthcare? How come we're the only developed nation, for all intensive purposes, that doesn't have universal health care? Is that a good idea? So those are some ideas that may stimulate you to want to talk to us. I can answer questions as much as best I can on medical issues, but particularly I'm strong in pediatrics and pediatric issues, issues affecting birth through adolescent care, allergies and asthma and hay fever. But I'll do my best on other things. Prentice is a social worker, deals a lot with family problems, depression, anxiety, school issues. He's more than happy to address those as well. So, Prentice, let's get started before we get some phone calls. What is anxiety? What does that mean to you?
Well, I think, first of all, I'll chime in on the healthcare thing. One of the biggest drawbacks to some of the changes that they were talking about was the removal of mental health care as a mandatory option, something that is provided. So people without mental health care will be accessing their medical doctors and emergency rooms and things at a higher rate. So for my two cents, and I hear you talk about that all the time, is that mental health care should probably be the thing that is provided, and physical health care be the backup.
Like, I have said that.
You've said that on a number of occasions. So, one of the reasons I say that is because of anxiety disorders. Like, anxiety disorders, I got a couple of interesting stats here, but out of the people 18 years and older, 18% of the population experiences an anxiety disorder of some type. That's almost one in five people walking around experiencing some sort of anxiety, be it a phobia, a social anxiety disorder, fear of, going out. I guess agoraphobia would be another one, fear of going out. I guess I can just go through the seven categories of anxiety disorders that I found. Generally, in most places you look, they sort of break them down like this. Generalized anxiety disorder, which is sort of the fear of of everything. Something bad's going to happen. I call it anticipated suffering. Like, there's something bad is going to happen here pretty soon. And so your brain, anxiety is a natural response, right? It's something that we all need in order to survive. If the bear came around the corner and we had no anxiety, it would simply come and eat us and we would, you know, pet it or whatever we would do. But the anxiety responses are bodies, our brain's reaction to a perceived threat. And so if that those alarm bells go off, we have the fight, flight, or freeze response. If the alarm bells go off, our respiration increases, our heart rate increases, cortisol, the stress hormones flood our body, and we prepare to defend ourselves or run away from whatever that perceived threat is. So that's anxiety disorder. When it gets to a point where it is interfering with our functioning, we worry too much, we can't get through the day without, you know, like, it's normal to worry about your kids, it's normal to worry about an upcoming presentation or a radio show on a Monday afternoon. I mean, those things are all anxiety producing. But if it gets to the point where you can't function, you can't go out in public, you're afraid of, you know, medical anxiety manifests itself. We were talking about that with heart. You know, people think they have heart attacks. So the seven types of anxiety disorders, generalized anxiety disorder, as I said, 3.1% of the population. Social anxiety disorder, 6.8% of the population. That's a big number for social anxiety disorder. If you think about teenagers, many of the kids I work with have social anxiety problems. And if you're a teenager, your parents are telling you you need to get to school, you need to engage in sports, join a club, but you are terrified of failure. You are terrified of being out there and being seen and made fun of. Many kids with, you know, are considered shy, but it is not shyness. People say, you know, well, it's just shyness and we've somehow medicated it, but a true social anxiety disorder or a social phobia is something that is really debilitating for, especially for teenagers, but for adults too. Panic disorders, 2.7% of the population. Agoraphobia, which is really is a panic disorder gone haywire. It's the fear of going out to places. I worked with a lady one time that the only time she would go grocery shopping was at like 2 o'clock in the morning because she did not want to run into anybody. The crowds were low. She knew that if she had a panic attack, sometimes people with panic attacks get a fear of the panic, right? And it can create its own panic attack. So it's no longer about anything other than the fear of the fear itself. So panic disorders are quite debilitating, agoraphobia. Special phobias, specific phobias, we all know about that, like spiders and snakes and things, but that's at 8.7. And women are twice as likely for those types of phobias, specific phobias. Post-traumatic stress disorder listed as an anxiety disorder, about 3.5%. A lot of things can cause PTSD. It used to be really limited to military war kind of, you know, people who saw those sorts of atrocities. Now, child abuse, long-term exposure, to aggressive homes, violent homes, rape, severe life-threatening car accidents, things like that associated with PTSD now. And then obsessive-compulsive disorder, which is sort of the last category, OCD, which is about 1% of the population. So those are the kind of highlights of the different anxiety disorders. But it's sort really, really important to point out that anxiety is normal. It happens to everybody. We all have a certain level of anxiety, some more so than others. But it is, it can be quite debilitating for people who experience it. And they have a very difficult time managing relationships, jobs, school, social activities. So it has a huge cost. And that's the other thing that we talked about. I know doctors see a lot of anxiety stuff. So what's your take on anxiety stuff from the medical perspective?
Yeah, I'm going to have a couple of questions, but let me just remind listeners, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Prentice Pemberton. The two of us are here to answer your questions about health and health care. And so you're free to give us a call about any question you have, 550-8433, 550-8433, our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Prentice and I are right now, we're talking about anxiety, but we're here to answer questions about anything you would like to have us try to help you with. So, Prentice, I agree. Anxiety is very common. You said 18%, so about 1 in 5 of people 18 years of age and older. So my first question that came to mind when you were given those statistics, what's the origin of anxiety? And the reason I would say that is you gave statistics for 18 years of age and older, and I clearly see anxiety maybe even less than 2 years of age in individuals. So what's the etiology is the medical term? What's the source maybe? Why do we have anxiety that is interfering with our life?
Well, obviously we go back to the great debate of nature versus nurture. And anxiety disorders seem to be, the research indicates that it seems to be, it's a combination of environment and genetics and our sort of predisposition. I know everybody's heard stories or knows babies, you know, two siblings that are from the same family, but they have very different startle responses. They have very different views about the world. One may be very outgoing and energetic. One may be withdrawn and isolated or just more private and quiet and introspective. And those are sort of predisposed, like we're sort of born with kind of a temperament or a personality.
Yep. Yep.
And how our environment influences that, how it interacts with the genetic makeup, and how we sort of develop our sense of self, our sense of safety, our sense of security in the world. That's where I think the roots of anxiety and the statistics I gave for adults, but anxiety is born long before that. Nobody really, I mean, in a traumatic sort of experience, you would develop PTSD, or you might go through a life change that might create an anxiety thing. You might have some medical problems that might create an anxiety disorder of some type as an adult because you go through a series of events or, you know, difficult mm-hmm. times. But as a general rule, people are sort of already well-wired by the time they hit 18 as to how they view the world. And is it a safe place? Is it a scary place? Is something bad going to happen? Really, is the glass half empty or half full? And so I think it's a complex interaction, but I do know that, you know, in my own practice and talking to my peers and reading the literature, there's a clear link genetically. You see family patterns that go on for generations sometimes of anxiety disorders or phobias, or, you know, your Aunt Martha was quirky, right? And she counted things over and over again, or some sort of OCD, and it manifests in different way in different people. But I think that the environment impacts our biology, and that sort of combination and what we get kind of boils to the surface as adults, and that's how we view the world.
How do you talk to somebody who's got anxiety that's pre-existing from early in life? And here's the reason I come up with a question. I used to talk to people with asthma all the time and say, listen, if you've never breathed well, how do you know that, you know, what it's like to be normal? So if you've always had some anxiety, how and when does it dawn on you, or does it dawn on you, that you're different in your unwillingness to interact socially with people? That may be the most difficult. I could see how pretty quickly our environment lets us know you're weird, that you have to jump back and forth but through that door every time you walk through it, but not realizing how uncomfortable they feel in a crowd or in certain situations is definitely maybe not so obvious.
Yeah, I think the fact that they're in my office or they have gone to speak to somebody indicates to them that there's a problem. Something doesn't feel right. Something, they're not happy. They're not content. They don't have a girlfriend, or they don't have enough friends, or they're just worried all the time. They can't sleep. They're up all night, tossing and turning. They feel inadequate, not good enough. So there's all these themes. And people are really, really relieved to hear that it's a thing, mm-hmm. right? Like, actually to communicate to somebody, like, this sounds like some, you know, pretty haywire anxiety going on here. And if you talk to them long enough, they will tell you that it's irrational, mm-hmm. that it doesn't make sense to them. And that's why they're there, that they know at some level there's not anything to fear. But, you know, it's like I talked to one fellow and, I compared it to every sound. You're walking down a trail and every sound you hear in the woods is a grizzly bear, and you start screaming in panic if you're having panic attacks, and a squirrel hops out of the woods, right? So it's important. And this is how sort of we talk about when we start to treat, is it's important to really be able to intellectualize what it is that you're fearful of in that moment. And so for people to start to increase their awareness of their anxiety, I talk to folks about mental illness sort of like you probably talk to people about asthma or diabetes, is like you have it. Right. Mm-hmm. It's diabetes is a thing. And but you can live mm-hmm. a successful life and you can be healthy and you can have relationships and you can function. But you have to be aware that you have this mm-hmm. thing. We all have something. Mm-hmm. Find the person that you know or that I know that doesn't have a challenge at some point, be it a physical, a physical illness, an accident, a mental health diagnosis that carries with them, addiction, it goes on and on, diabetes, heart disease. We all get something at some point. It's how, Dr. Jennifer Beath, who's been a guest on the show a bunch of times, said it really well when she said, we can't get through life without pain. But if we embrace the pain and we say, what else is there after the pain? We have this anxiety. What does it mean to us? What does it mean in our relationships? And how do we work through it and find value? So the relief that a lot of people have, they're like, oh, really? I'm not the only one that feels this way. I mean, they know it mm-hmm. somewhere. But when you say it out loud and for them to begin to verbalize it and talk about it, kind of normalizes the experience a little bit. I mean, something happens at 20%. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty high saturation rate. It's kind of like ADHD. Yeah. How abnormal is ADHD, really?
Right. Yeah, I guess I would say it's just the differences in all of us, not necessarily saying that that's a particular
right.
disease or something. And we can get into semantics about whether we over-diagnose or over-somaticize all our problems. We do have a caller, but I want to do a little bit more work on this anxiety issue. But before I do that, I want to encourage some calls again to remind listeners this is Line One, your health connection. Prentice Pimpernan, co-host of Line One, and myself are here to address your questions about mental health, behavioral health, health, and health care. You can reach us during the next 45 minutes or so at 550-8433. 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. If you're holding on a phone call, let me get you to hold on just a little bit longer, then we'll take your question. So the issue of anxiety driving healthcare costs, we have a tremendous problem with healthcare costs in this country. We are approaching 18% of all the money we produce or income we produce in this country being spent for healthcare. And it takes away, is the way I think of it, from everything else we need to be doing. Infrastructure, education comes to mind very, very quickly. So when I see people, often they have anxiety. Usually I would say it's generalized anxiety, to put a specific diagnosis, and they're worried about some health issue. And you might go along and say, okay, I'll clear up this health issue by doing this test. The problem with the test is a lot of tests have some false positives. That is, a positive doesn't mean anything. That may lead to further anxiety, further testing. Then a procedure may be done. That causes some potential problems in healthcare costs. And then the other thing that dawned on me while I was thinking about this, there's also the anxiety on the other side, the professionals, the physicians. There are different styles of practice. Some physicians are much more anxious about missing something and do a lot more testing as right. well. And others are much more confident in the clinical judgment of what they're doing and use tests to sometimes just to kind of verify they're already understood diagnosis of what's going on. So it is a big cause of healthcare. I think you said you had some numbers about how much this is costing.
Yeah, you mentioned you wanted to say that. And I had actually, when I was doing research in the healthcare costs of this, the U.S. Spends more than $42 billion with a B dollars a year, almost one third of the country's $148 billion total mental health bill is on anxiety disorders, and over half of that, so 22, almost $23 billion in costs are associated with the repeated use of healthcare services. So people with anxiety disorders seek out treatment for symptoms that really are mimicking physical illness, but they're 3 to 5 times more likely to go to the doctor for a medical complaint, and 6 times more likely to be hospitalized for psychiatric disorders than those who don't suffer from anxiety disorders. So that's a those are some big numbers, and it shows you the weight that anxiety disorders have on our system, both the mental health care system and, you know, and the medical system.
All right. Well, I'm going to take a phone call, and if we have time and opportunity, we'll come back and talk about maybe treatment and who needs treatment and what works. Kelsey, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hey, can you guys hear me?
Yes, we sure can.
All right, thanks. I have a 7-year-old daughter, and at our last just well child check, the pediatrician had noticed she has kind of some signs of puberty already starting. And then kind of she's always just been a fairly mellow, not the terrible twos or tantrums and stuff, but I feel like within this last year she's had more times of just crying really hard and being really unable to deal with her little sister and kind of just more emotional stuff that I'm wondering if it's hormonal.
Yep.
And I just wondered where if you guys, with both the kind of pediatrician and the mental health guy, had tips on what you do with
All right. So my first thought may be that it is hormonal related to early puberty. But I would not go there first. I think there's a lot of other much more likely explanations and just the normal stresses of the day and so forth. And two, true precocious puberty is pretty uncommon. So that's my thinking. So my first question is, what are we talking about with early puberty? Are we talking about just breast development? Are we talking about pubic hair? Are we talking about axillary hair? Are we talking about...
pubic hair was what we noticed.
So no breast development, but true pubic hair or just fine, downy, soft, maybe dark hair?
Kind of in the finer, softer.
Yeah. So I'm not so sure that is really, in my mind, precocious puberty. We'll see that in little girls occasionally. If it's not true pubic hair, I don't necessarily think you're into early puberty. And the first sign of puberty in girls is breast development. Normally, and it would be usually what you get is a nodule, a tender nodule under your nipple. It may be one-sided, maybe not, maybe pea-sized, maybe a little bigger. So again, based on experience and how common things are, I'm not convinced that you're really into precocious puberty, and you're quite at that crux. 7 to 8 nowadays, we start maybe seeing a little early, and the reason we think we see it early is obesity, not hormones that are other places, by the way. So now let's, if I've convinced you, let's talk about, let Prentice talk to you about some of the behavioralists. So suddenly at a 7, she's a little bit more emotional than she used to be.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have any other questions for me about that before I pass you over?
No, that's helpful. Thanks.
All right. Great.
How's she doing in other areas of her life? I guess that's the first question.
Yeah, she's fine. I think it's helpful. She does well in school. She's, you know, sweet and figures things out. I think maybe with having the doctor mention that to me, I've had sort of added
anxiety.
Yeah. 20%.
Yes. Yeah, welcome to the club.
Yeah.
By the way,
I think anxiety is more common than we know, and I think women don't have a higher proportion. I think men just never go to the doctor, never talk about it. But that's besides the point.
I think, Dr. Woodard, that's true for most mental health disorders. Women seek out treatment quite more frequently.
Yep.
So your daughter at 7, moody, mostly at home, sister, sibling stuff you mentioned. Is that right?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that tends to be what she jumps to blame, at least when she's feeling upset. She'll be like, act like her sister had done something, even though usually it didn't.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I have three delightful girls at home. They're 11, 11, 8, and 6, and they're delightful everywhere but my house. So definitely you want to keep an eye on it. You know, Dr. Woodard mentioned that precocious puberty is pretty rare. I've had maybe two in my time, you know, 15 years of you know, working with teenagers. The last 15 years anyway, I guess it's been a lot more than that now. But yeah, I mean, the puberty, like 9, 8, 9, 10, breast development, it's pretty common now, and it seems to be earlier and earlier. But I would keep an eye on things and, you know, check in with her. If you have real concerns, if the tantrum has become, you know, uncontrollable, or things start to break, or they just go into, you know, if they continue and escalate, then I'd go ahead and maybe get her hooked up with a therapist who can talk to her about what's going on. There might be something at school. You know, I had one of my kids for a while, didn't want to go to school every day, but she was getting targeted by a kid at school. So, and her, you know, she was saying her stomach hurt and all this stuff. And, the reason I asked about school is because, you know, sometimes kids, if they're not doing well in school, if they don't want to read or they don't want to show up, they'll, you know, they'll be acting out. Or if they hold it together at school all day, the thing about home is it's the safest place in the world to do this stuff. You know, your mom is going to love you no matter what. So you can save all the good stuff. But if your child is interacting well with other kids and go over, you know, other parents are telling you how wonderful your child is, and it's nice to get that feedback, but that means they're probably doing okay. Kids that I see that have a true mood disorder or some sort of dysregulation problem with their emotions, they can't hold it together at school very long. They have trouble, you know, with their peers and things like that. So keep an eye on how she's doing globally overall.
Awesome. All right. Good luck to the rest of your call.
Thanks. Yeah, well, thanks for your call, Kelsey. I hope we helped you.
Appreciate it.
All right, we've got another caller. George, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, this is George, and I was calling because I've got a family member in his 50s who had been prescribed citalopram for general anxiety for a long time, I guess probably 10 years or something. And it was seemed like the anxiety was returning, so he his doctor had him switch to, I think it was venlafaxine or something like that.
All right.
And I think they act differently. I think the first one's supposed to be an SSRA and the other one's an SNRA, which I don't know that much about. But the switch, though, seems to cause a lot of problems, like a lot of insomnia, and mm-hmm. then the anxiety was still there.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, mm-hmm. he's dealing with it. But
yeah.
I was just wondering, are there a lot of problems like that when medicines switch, or is there a need to, like, taper off drugs when those kind of things
Yeah, so
because they didn't tell him to taper off the first drug.
Yeah, as a rule, you should taper off any of the SSRIs or the medications you're on. They affect serotonin, and you can get an increase in serotonin reaction as you stop them, which can make you more agitated, more difficulty maybe sleeping, maybe you'll feel a little nauseated, you know, cold and clammy, that kind of stuff. And it would depend on perhaps the drug, your individual chemistry, and what medication you're on, and in which ones. So as a general rule, my comments about the medications are the treatments of national treatments of choice recommendations are what am I trying to say? Not behavior modification, but psychotherapy. I'm blanking on the classic treatment that you use, psychotherapy now for.
Oh, like you're talking about cognitive behavioral therapy?
Yeah, cognitive behavioral therapy. I think that's the generally something along that line is the treatment of choice. And then medications may be necessary if someone's bad enough, or I think there are people that just have so much innate genetic predisposition to anxiety that they may need some medications. But oftentimes you may need medication just so the psychotherapy can begin to kick in. But the idea with most of the time, not all, most of the time with medications, is that that's not the long-term treatment idea. So the different medications that you're using clearly may have a little bit of different side effects. Generally, they're extremely safe medications if used appropriately. Sedation can be a little bit of an issue sometimes. We'll sometimes see people, and I don't see this in my age group, but I know that in older individuals that it can decrease your sexual interest a little bit. But, you know, serious side effects are pretty unlikely, but you can ramp up and make things a little worse if you stop them suddenly. So I don't know if that helps answer your question, George.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I really kind of wondered about also that, you know, the length of taking that citalopram for 10 years and if that's normal to be.
Yeah, it can be. And, I'm not, when you said citalopram, my first thought was whether it was a Valium-like derivative. And it may not be. I'd have to look it up. But I would say that the Valium-like medications are very good at relieving anxiety, but they're highly can get you into some dependency issues. And that is something that generally is, I think, not being a psychiatrist, but is frowned upon for long-term use for either sleep issues or anxiety issues. The SSRI-like products are much, much, much safer for people who need a longer-term treatment.
Well, the citalopram was described as an SSRI.
Okay. Yeah, I think you said that, and when I heard the pram on the end of it, and it's just not the one I use the most, and I was a little bit anxious about maybe being a Valium derivative. But if it's an SSRI, then I'm not aware of any significant worry about dependency on the SSRI medication.
Now, George, is your person being followed by a psychiatrist or just a family physician?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's following up both in terms of therapy of some sort, and I think there is a psychiatrist.
Okay. Well, then they're definitely, I mean, on the right path. And some medications, I'll tell you, a lot of the adults I work with have taken medications for many, many years with success once they find the specific thing that works well. And then sometimes over time, that'll lose its effectiveness and the doctors will try to tweak it. And it's not an exact science. Now, I'm not a psychiatrist, so I can't speak to specific meds, but I do know the practice is very much, you know, it's not an exact science. You can't say, oh, this will do this and this will do this, because each person reacts differently to different meds. So it's important that they either have like a journal that he tracks how they're feeling at any given time, that everything that they do very much clear with the doctor, the psychiatrist, talk to your therapist, and let everybody else know, because a lot of times it's other people that notice things rather than the patient himself.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call, George.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks.
All right. We are already more than halfway through. Boy, Prentice, when you're having fun. I can't believe we're that far. Anyway, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We have a caller holding on. I'm going to ask them to hold on a little bit longer. And after this break, Prentice and I will continue to discuss topics of concern to our listeners. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Actually, I'm your co-host, because also with me today is the other Line 1 co-host and licensed clinical social worker, Prentice Pimpernan. Today, we're encouraging phone calls and emails from listeners so that we might answer any questions you have about health and healthcare concerns. Up to this point, we've talked a little bit about anxiety and answered a couple of phone calls, and we've got one more pending. But if you've got any sort of question about children or health or mental health or healthcare system, why don't you give us a call? We'll be here for another 25 minutes or so. Again, our local number, 550-8433, our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. And remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 on this evening, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, so we won't be able to take your question. Carolyn, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, this is Caroline. My reason for calling is I love economics, and I always look at how people evaluate things, and they look at the immediate cost, not just the future cost, and most certainly they don't look at the opportunity cost. So if we have a young person who is in an abusive home, and unfortunately there's far too many of those, and they might come into a situation where they're going to need to be in juvenile detention. My understanding from some figures a few years back that it was about the cost of a year at Harvard to incarcerate a young person. Mm-hmm. So again, what could that person become? It's not just what it costs. You know, it's kind of like a pay now or pay later sort of approach that we should be taking, I think, because you know, we're 14th on the happiness scale,
right.
And why don't we look at the countries that are in the top five and see what they're doing that we're not doing. You know, I look at the drug numbers that come out, you know, people taking opiates and that sort of thing. Why? What's wrong with our society that people are so desperate, bored, unhappy, whatever,
right,
that drives them to that? So those are some of the things. And many years ago I heard that the Plains Indians referred to the whites coming across as the people who beat their children.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a generational thing. How long is it going to take us before that is pretty well washed out?
Right. I think you are on to something very, very important, and it's not hard for a pediatrician to understand this issue. It's not hard for anybody in mental health or behavioral health to understand this issue. And I'm going to use an answer that I use with patients every day in the office, and I think I wish every legislator in the world could hear this answer, and maybe it's not right, but I'll bet I'll get them to thinking about where we ought to be putting our money. And that, the way I would answer it is this. You get, first off, one of the better lines I've ever heard is the first day of education, the most important time of education, the first day, school doesn't start the first day of education doesn't start the first day of school, it starts the first day of life. And to expand on that even further, you get 80% of your adult head size between 2 and 3 years of age. And the reason your brain is growing so fast, it's not that we're getting more neurons, more cells. It's not that the cells that are already there are growing in larger size. Our brain grows because of stimulation, it begins, the neurons that are there get stimulated to send out dendrites, little branches, think of them as roots, to talk to other neurons, to set up physical circuits that begin to talk to each other. And we now know that the more you stimulate a circuit to play basketball, to play baseball, to see, the better that circuit works, the more myelin gets laid down, the less mistakes it makes. So you get 80% of your adult head size by age 2 or 2 to 3. So by the time you're 2 or 3, a lot of the rest of your life on how you look at things is done. That helps me understand why it's hard to change habits, and it explains why we're paying a lot of money later for all of the things that have happened early in our life that are really very difficult and very expensive to change. I don't want listeners to say it's impossible to change, but we all will, the rest of our life, we're going to have these circuits that have helped help kids early in life learn how people interact with each other. What happens when stress? What happens when they have people fighting in their same house? What happens if all their neighbors are having to be worried about gunshots? So, again, at those first 3 years. So, to me, that helps me understand the question you just gave. Does that help you, or does that make sense to you? That's the opportunity cost that's lost.
Yeah, and I didn't realize there was that much growth in the human head. But yep. At the same time, they're just now beginning to study the idea of knowledge being transferred genetically. And if that is true, then we're, you know, if you've got a poisoned environment, poisoned parents or whatever, how is that going to help the child if they have all of the knowledge that's just that, if they don't see any bright sunshine or nice
right.
skies
or
just feeling loved? How
right.
in the world can people make it through this world if they don't feel loved?
Well, they make it, but they change, and their way of coping begins to be some of the problem.
Yeah, well, that's, again, it's a question. Some people, you can't appeal to them any other way but through their pocketbook. That was one of my father's quotes. And we need to look at the opportunity cost. What
right.
are we
right.
wasting?
Yep. No. A lot of countries, particularly Scandinavian countries, are putting a lot of money into the early childhood. And I think that's, as we understand child development and social problems, that's a big, it makes a lot of sense at this point in our understanding of those things. Prentice is itching to say some comments here. Let me before you comment, let me see what Prentice has to say.
Yes, Caroline, thank you for that. The cost, two quotes jumped out at me while I was listening to that. Our brains are wired based on usage. So if you take a small child and you raise them in a violent, war-torn country, let's say they're growing up in somewhere where they're exposed to a lot of murder and anger and hostility. I mean, you have 13-year-olds with, assault rifles, and they're cutting off heads. People, that's not a child that you could then take into a home and at 13 or 14 and then just be really nice and love him on up. The other quote that I heard was the California penal system is the largest mental health center in the world. And that is something that rings true. If you look at the incidences of mental health, and I don't know the numbers right off the top of my head, for people with diagnosable mental health conditions that are in the penal system, it is a huge number. Lots of violence, lots of backgrounds with early childhood exposure to trauma and excessive violence, and maybe one parent, lots of that stuff going on. And it's really hard to undo that, as Dr. Woodard said. And the cost of, not only, as you said, the cost of treating that and trying to change that or incarcerating that is excessive. And the cost of changing it is incredibly high. And so why not put that money into early childhood development and early health programs and mental wellness programs for families? And then you avoid all that, and then hopefully you avoid the penal system down the road. So that's a great point, Caroline. One that requires a lot of forethought, though, by our political leaders and taking a different approach to crime and punishment, maybe.
Well, you know, one quote that I will give, supposedly it was Warren Buffett, but I didn't hear him say it, so, you know, it could have been just given to him. And that is that we either do or do not have the luck of the womb. So who were you born to? What country
yep.
were you born in? What
yep.
color were you
mm-hmm.
born?
Right.
I mean, all of these things. And some people that are hard charging and they've been successful, well, I did it, why don't they?
Right.
Attitude.
Right.
And of
right.
course, we all are formed so differently.
Yep.
And then the other thing that bothers me is our prison system. It's privatized. So the incentive is to warehouse humans, you know, and it just makes absolutely no sense to me. But, you know, if we were paying people based upon their dropping the recidivism rate and having people coming out of those places with an education and a willingness to work and a job and yamma, 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 that would at least ameliorate the fact that, you know, we've got a profit center in incarcerating people.
Right.
All righty. Thank you, sirs, for all you do.
Great points, and thanks for bringing it up. I think it's an important issue to, for people to think about and hear about.
We don't ever hear about layoffs in the correctional system. Like, they're not firing correctional workers, unfortunately.
All right. Got an email. Oh, let me announce one more time that you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. On the program today, myself and Prentice Pemberton, our co-host, a licensed clinical social worker, are trying to address questions and comments that you might have about health care, mental health, behavioral health, you name it. So if you've got questions or comments, why don't you give us a call? 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433. And I'll just give our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. And we're going to be here for about another 12 or 13 minutes. I do have an email, Prentice. This is a pretty good one. My 19-year-old has high-functioning autism. What really affected her, however, is her anxiety and OCD. Her psychologist here locally sent us to a hospital, I guess in Wisconsin, for help. We spent 10 weeks there, and they discharged us saying that she was, end quote, treatment resistant, end quote. She has what I would call PTSD from the experience and says she'll not see a psychologist ever again. She dropped out of high school. We have just worked on getting her mental health more stable and put school on the back burner. It has been 2 years now, and she is better, but still can't deal with school and has no friends, saying I'm her only friend, meaning her mother. What can we do at this point to help her if she refuses seeing a therapist or a psychologist? My thanks for your insights. I would say that in my experience with autism, that anxiety is often a big issue. And it can be very difficult. I think being high functioning in autism leads to the possibility of psychotherapy being beneficial, but often with at least lower functioning autistic kids, medication is more commonly done, and I have found generally helpful. So I don't know where you've been. I suspect you've been through the medication issue. And if she's got anxiety, then you get into this issue. She's also maybe anxious about therapy and medications, being worried about the effects of medication. That's part of the anxiety issue. I'm not sure what to suggest other than a very good psychologist, mental health person, at this point, given a 19-year-old with high-functioning autism having this trouble. But let's see what Prentice has to say.
It's a great question, and it's a common problem. I have, I don't know, 4 or 5 high-functioning Asperger autistic young folks that I work with. And the challenge is, I mean, high-functioning is a term. I mean, we're talking about a spectrum. But high-functioning is, it seems like, those individuals get stuck between what we want to call, for lack of a better term, quote unquote, normal cognitive functioning and this Asperger spectrum. And they really want to be socially adept. They want to have friends. They want to have a girlfriend. They want to have a job. And they keep failing in these areas. They keep having struggles in these certain areas. Peer relationships are super hard for people with Asperger's or the autism spectrum disorder. And so that's where I see most of it is I want to be included. I want to be just a regular person who goes out, who has dates, who has friends, who hangs out with people. And one of the things I notice about autism, and you know, this may or may not be true, but I think it is just based on my observations, but and from my conversations with my peers, is that this sort of anxiety stuff manifests in middle school. Like as we come into puberty and we start to realize the differences in people, if you watch young children play with other kids who are, be they in a wheelchair, be they be a different race, maybe they have autism, Down syndrome, kids just play. Kids are just kids. They figure it out. They play a thing. But once we hit adolescence, we start to, you know, individuate and we become aware of our own place in the social system and the structure. And that's super hard for young people who don't know why they can't make friends, right? Who don't know why they can't build relationships like other people around them and other people in their family even. They watch the successes around them. So it is really hard. And I'm with Dr. Woodard on the fact that if you can get her to just go see somebody, you know, make sure the threat of any sort of residential thing is off the table. It's just a place for her. And now as an adult, to figure out, you know, it was different when she was a kid. You were trying to help her. But now how is your daughter going to navigate into adulthood? Where is she going to find her place to earn a living, to, you know, to understand herself and her spot in the world? As I said earlier, we all have challenges. Some people it's Asperger's, some people it's diabetes, some people it's addiction, some people, you know, it's trauma. Everybody's got a challenge, but finding a good therapist who can really get her engaged and maybe even get her involved in some kind of group. One of the problems is the isolation that people feel and the loneliness. And I've had that with several of the young people because maybe they don't drive. They have anxiety about catching the bus and they end up isolated and they obsess. The anxiety and the OCD, pretty common in some of the kids that I work with. Very obsessive thinking. So those are the thoughts off the top of my head. If you can somehow convince her that it's her appointment without you, without parents, like, unless she invites you in, that's maybe a good first approach is for her to have somewhere to talk that's not mom and dad who are super anxious and worried about her, right? Give her some options.
What about exploring her interests, her affinities, what she's really interested in, and trying to work through the socialization of that with that aspect?
That's one of the challenges. How do you find use for your time and something that gives you passion and joy? And you know, for these kids transitioning, you know, a lot of them live at home and they really want independence, but it's not going to happen maybe for a long time, if ever. But yeah, finding some sort of activity. And as I said, a lot of these young adults end up isolated. Their only real friends are their parents. They spend a lot of time with mom or dad or both. And it's difficult, but finding some sort of skill, a trade. I had this one young man that once he figured out like that he had a really good ability to weld, and he went into welding and became really, really good at it. It was like a really cathartic experience, a craft for him. He became really good at doing beads, and he would bring me these little welded projects. But that was something that interested him. He loved to work with metal and ended up turning it into a job. So finding some sort of another girl I work with really likes to file, right? She likes to order things and put them in, you know, where they're supposed to be. And that's going to be something we're hoping to develop with her into a skill where she can earn a living wage and do a job. So, and then socialization is the other thing. Looking out, organizations like Challenge Alaska do a lot of socializing for people with special needs and different disabilities, autism. So finding an organization like that is a good start as well, getting involved in some activities or maybe some camps that are specifically designed for that.
This may be a question that's more helpful to me than the woman who wrote this question, but I still, in my mind, would like to know your experience with medications. Successful, not successful, side effects, anxiety causing the people to stop the medications. I just think this is a situation where there's a reasonable chance of success with medications. However, it may all be that they've been there and done that and hadn't worked. So do you find that can be helpful or not?
I find that it can be very helpful. In fact, a case a while back that I had was a young person, 20, who really, really struggled with obsessive thoughts and just kept going over and over and over all these old past transgressions that had happened over, you know, in junior high, even 6-7 years later, and just like couldn't think about anything else. Talked about how he was wronged and how he felt weird and strange. And once he got, they tried a bunch of different medications, but once they got it figured out, one of the things that he said to me at one point is like, wow, this Prozac, it was Prozac, the one that worked. He said, this Prozac really has quieted my brain.
Right.
That's what he said. And we didn't have the same conversations after that. We had very much problem-solving, solution-focused, forward-thinking. So medications can have a big impact, especially with that sort of obsessive kind of thinking and running things around in your brain over and over again. So definitely worth a look.
So I guess that our answer to this email is that we don't have all the information to have an answer, but continuing to look for a therapist that may help, continuing to work at helping her socialize and get into things that she feels good about and has success with, reconsidering or considering medication if it's not been there, and realize that the anxiety can make it sometimes difficult to get the treatment going because people start having symptoms related to their anxiety rather than the medication itself, and it's often can be very helpful. We also had a suggestion from a listener about Challenge Alaska, and I don't know if you mentioned that or not.
I just did, yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't remember. I was thinking of other things. So those are our thoughts, and I think I would certainly wish you the very best. This can be a tough, but not that unusual of a situation.
No, it's not unusual at all. It's pretty common, and there seem to be a whole bunch of young people in that kind of in between, like I can't really fit in, you know, in this world, and I don't really fit in that world, and they're trying to find a space, and that's the challenge for those parents, is to help them find a place and some meaning and some value and some friendships and connection, which is what we all want, right? Connection to other people. So that sounds like the biggest challenge.
We only have about a minute and a half or so, and we haven't really talked completely about treatment for anxiety. There are maybe different treatment options for different kinds of anxiety. I mentioned cognitive behavior. Do you want to just say something in a minute or so about treatment that we maybe haven't already mentioned about medications and cognitive behavioral therapy?
Treatment for anxiety is... it's super important because I mentioned the number of people with anxiety disorders, and only about 1/3 of people with anxiety disorders actually get treatment for it. So that's part of the problem, is that not enough people are seeking it. The ideal combination for anxiety disorders, and really depression too, is a combination, especially for adults, of medication and psychotherapy in conjunction, and then you moderate the medication as you go. But no matter what type of anxiety you're dealing with, find out your specific type of anxiety, accept that anxiety is a problem, understand the causes and triggers, break them into smaller pieces that you feel like you can manage, and that'll help you change your anxiety. But you do that with a therapist and a support group of people around you. Find a therapist and get to work.
Thanks.
Thank you. It's fun.
So my thanks to co-host Prentice Pemberton for joining us this week. This was not his week to work here, but he volunteered to come in and share his expertise. I hope everyone appreciates that and as much as I did. If you want to continue this discussion, you can join KSKA on Facebook. You can find that link on our website at www.alaskapublic.org, where you can also find the Line 1 archives to numerous programs in the past, and you can listen to those programs again if you'd like. You can also let us know your thoughts and suggestions at line1@alaskapublic.org. Next week, Prentice is going to co-host the show, and his guest is Dr. Delaney Rustin. She is a filmmaker at Stanford University and a physician, and she's made a film called Screen Agers, talking about and discussing the effects of screens on adolescents. So why not join him next week? Dave Waldron was today's audio engineer. Eric Bork is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.